Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we are again after a momentous week in politics.
Yes, good to be here, Dennis.
What a week it was. Former President Donald Trump indicted by a federal grand jury, and that means the presidential campaign trail will now run through the courts. The former president was indicted for his handling of classified documents after he left the presidency. There's plenty to talk about here, plenty to download. Laura, kick it off.
Yes, first I want to emphasize, as we discussed after the previous indictment, like anyone charged with any crime, Donald Trump is presumed innocent. And the charging document is very strong, but it is just the prosecution's case. We have not seen anything from the Trump side. Two of his defense attorneys stepped down after the indictment was filed. And so his attorneys have not yet filed their response. But this is not a circumstantial case or a complicated case that's difficult to connect the dots to Trump. These 37 counts, 31 of them are related to mishandling documents that he didn't have a right to have. And then the others range from making false statements to concealing to obstruction of justice. And much of the evidence comes from recorded statements made by Trump himself, photographs taken by Trump's own staff. And so there is a lot of evidence, not only that classified documents were still being kept and being hidden at Trump residences, but also that the former president knew that some of the material was classified and that he had not declassified it.
This is the first time in American history that a former president has faced federal charges. And among the top secret and other classified records were details on foreign nations' nuclear capabilities, as well as information regarding defense and weapons capabilities of both the U.S. and foreign countries, U.S. nuclear programs, potential vulnerabilities of the U.S. and its allies to military attack. In other words, these were not minor league documents.
No, and some of them were so classified that the classification markings were redacted from the indictment, the unsealed indictment, because even just to reproduce the markings might give away too much. And some of the documents, for instance, were only for the eyes of the United States, the Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. I mean, some of these were supposed to be very, very closely held. And so it is very serious. And in fact, even the former attorney general under President Trump, Bill Barr, he was on Fox News on Sunday, and he said Donald Trump isn't the victim, that he had no right to these documents, and these are some of the most important secrets the country has.
Of course, the president denies any wrongdoing. In appearances this weekend in Georgia and North Carolina, he said the federal indictment was the latest in what he called a long line of witch hunts against him. He has consistently used that term. And what he called this vicious prosecution is a travesty of justice. And the President Biden trying to jail his leading political opponent, that would be Donald Trump.
Yes, and that has been the statement, as you say, that has been a consistent line of attack from Donald Trump, and it's something that he will continue to say. Of course, his lawyers are still going to have to mount some kind of a defense in court, and they're going to have to refute some of the facts that are in the charging document, because clearly he's not going to plead out. I mean, I saw some commentary from defense attorneys who said that if they had a client facing this kind of indictment, they would immediately try to reach a plea agreement. But obviously, that's not something that's ever going to happen in this case.
This takes us into territory that we've never even come close to being in. The president has said, former president, he is going to stay in the race, even if he were to be convicted in federal court. And speaking of federal court, he's going to appear tomorrow, Tuesday, in Miami, and authorities are taking big time security precautions.
Yes, and it really is a strange moment in politics right now, because if you think about how many political careers have ended because of criminal charges, I mean, local, state level politicians, members of Congress, former governors. It is really striking. I mean, normally this would just be a political career ending type of occurrence. And yet Donald Trump is not only determined to stay in the race, but still has quite a lot of support, according to polls that were just published today. So, I mean, it is just it, like you say, it is uncharted territory, and we're going to have to see how it plays out. And although the special counsel, Jack Smith, said that he hopes to have a speedy trial, it's very possible that this trial will not be wrapped up by the time of the 2024 general election.
He was not the only one. Mr. Trump was not the only one charged in this indictment.
Yes, his aide, his what they generally call a body man, his personal assistant, Walt Nauta, was also charged on several counts, concealing, making false statements to federal investigators, because they amassed a lot of evidence, including surveillance camera footage, texts from his own phone, pictures that he took of boxes, that he was moving boxes around that were supposed to be searched, subject to a federal subpoena.
Well, let's talk about the reaction to all of this from Republican politicians, starting with Governor Kim Reynolds. She posted a statement after the indictment was announced, saying it's a grave warning sign for the state of equal justice and public trust in government institutions. She and other politicians did not at all address the actual charges against the president or the former president.
I was very struck by the governor's statement on several levels. First of all, it was issued just a few minutes after the indictment was unsealed. And so there was no way that the governor or her staff could have read the 49-page indictment before issuing the statement. I mean, obviously it had already been reported that the former president had been indicted. But it did not, as you say, it did not engage with any of the facts of the case or the charges against Donald Trump. And in fact, it said the last line was 2024 can't come soon enough. So, in fact, portraying this criminal prosecution as another reason to vote Joe Biden out of office, as opposed to something that could be potentially disqualifying if the charges are proven to be accurate.
And that is basically what every other Republican politician did. In fact, both Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, U.S. Senators from Iowa, told a Congressional Record reporter today that they had not read the indictment, but that did not stop them from ripping it.
Yeah, so Chuck Grassley has been very critical of the Justice Department and the FBI. In fact, as we discussed last week, he was at Joni Ernst's Roast and Ride fundraiser and was talking about the deep state and people who were out to get Donald Trump. And so he told a reporter today that he hadn't read the indictment, which, I mean, he wasn't the only Republican senator. A number of Republican senators were telling reporters they hadn't read the indictment, which just it just seems to defy logic that the front runner for your party's presidential nomination has just been charged with 37 felonies, and 3 days later you didn't read the indictment. I mean, it is obviously the politicians would rather not engage with the substance of what the charges are.
Correct. And the other reactions from other presidential candidates, pretty much down the same line with a couple of exceptions, whether it's Ron DeSantis, who decried the weaponization of the Justice Department, Mike Pence accusing the Justice Department of years-long politicization, again, not addressing the charges against Mr. Trump, just saying he shouldn't have been charged.
Yes, most of the other candidates were saying Trump should not have been charged. I did see today that Nikki Haley, who and her initial reaction was to be critical of the prosecution, but apparently today she said on Fox News, if this indictment is true, if what it says is actually the case, President Trump was incredibly reckless with our national security. So that was a much stronger statement than we've seen from the others. Vivek Ramaswamy said that if elected, he would pardon Donald Trump. Perry Johnson said that he would get rid of the FBI. I mean, it is really striking. Again, a criminal indictment like this would end most people's campaigns, but if it didn't end the campaign, you would think that the rivals for the office would then criticize the person who had been charged. But in fact, to have most of the other Republican presidential candidates defending Donald Trump, like I said, it's just a very strange moment in politics.
The only two who really spoke out against Trump were Asa Hutchinson and Chris Christie. Trump has disqualified himself, said Hutchinson. And Christie, who got into the race last week, and we're going to talk about that in just a couple of minutes, he said the facts are devastating. This is irresponsible conduct. That is what you would expect from Chris Christie because he's in the race just to savage Trump.
Absolutely. And Asa Hutchinson, remember when Trump was indicted before for what was a much more complicated case related to business and tax issues in the state of New York, and most of the Republican candidates denounced that indictment, and Asa Hutchinson said, well, we just have to keep an open mind, basically, and we need to see what this seems like. It could be serious. But now this is a much simpler case to understand. I mean, were these documents classified? Was he entitled to have them? Did he fail to give them back? Did he conceal them? I mean, that is not as complicated as the New York case. And so it was easier for Asa Hutchinson to say Trump is disqualified for himself. Asa Hutchinson is trying to carve out a lane in case I think Donald Trump completely self-destructs. And most of the other candidates are trying to keep their options open, I think, in case there is a Trump administration that they might have some position in it.
So those were the reactions from Republican candidates. What about the public? Well, there were new polls out this weekend. ABC and CBS had polls. The new ABC News poll showed that 48% of Americans, not a majority, but a plurality, think Trump should have been charged, but 35% say he should have, and somehow 17% don't have a clue about this.
Well, I mean, it's most people have not read all the details about the charges. So I'm not surprised that 17% said they're not sure about it, whether he should have been charged or not. But in both of these polls, Trump is very strong among Republican respondents, but his overall numbers are very weak. And so this supports the idea, I think, that many Democrats are hoping for, that if Trump is the nominee, that even though Joe Biden's approval ratings are not good, that this is a race that he could still win, because Trump's approval was never averaged above 50% at any time during his presidency, and it's very far below 50% now.
There was also a new CBS News poll, as I said, and that showed that only 7% of GOP primary voters say the indictment makes them think less of Trump. If there's any question about whether the Republican Party is a Trump party, that's pretty much it right there.
Yes, most of the respondents in that poll said that it doesn't change their opinion of Trump. And I thought it was very interesting. The top line was Trump still has a very big lead on Ron DeSantis. This is, again, among Republicans and nationally. This is not an Iowa poll, 61% to 23%. But it was interesting. They also asked respondents, which candidates are you considering? And they could give more than one answer. And there are still quite a lot of respondents who are considering Ron DeSantis or another candidate, but Trump is still ahead, even if there are about 75% of the respondents who said that Trump was among the candidates they're considering. And so he is still in a very strong position, and it shows that Ron DeSantis has a lot of ground to make up, never mind the other people. Of course, as more candidates enter the race, that's better for Trump because he has a better chance of getting a plurality of the vote in a crowded field than he does of beating someone one-on-one.
Which is what he did during the 2016 campaign, exactly. That same poll showed he is beating Ron DeSantis nationally 61 to 23%, which is a stunning number. So let's bottom line this now, and let's put some crystal balls into play here. Time for Dennis and Laura to crystal ball this. What does this possibly mean for the GOP race, both in Iowa and nationally?
Well, I think we have to see what happens in court. And I think it's very possible that not much will be resolved by the time of the Iowa caucuses early next year. The case is going to Judge Eileen Cannon, who was a Trump appointee and issued some very favorable rulings earlier this year, appointing a special master, or rather last year, rulings that delayed the progression of this case. And so it's very possible that a judge could delay the progression of this prosecution. Also, there are things that could happen with jury selection that could be favorable to Trump. I saw some speculation. Some of the charges are based on notes taken by Trump's former attorneys, and it's possible that those could be excluded as under the attorney-client privilege exception. And so some of the charges could be tossed out by the judge. I mean, so it could be that by the time we have the Iowa caucuses, that many Republicans feel that Trump has been vindicated, or at least that none of these charges have been proved yet. I mean, it's not likely that we're going to have a complete trial and jury verdict by early 2024.
Absolutely. And my guess is that at this moment, it makes no difference whatsoever. Trump is still the front runner for the Republican nomination by far.
Oh, clearly he's definitely the front runner. But I do think that over time, I mean, especially if there is an indictment in the Georgia investigation that's related to trying to influence the counting of votes or the results, the awarding of electoral votes from Georgia, there could be an indictment later this year in that case. And I mean, there may be people, you often hear this when people go to Republican events and they say that they really like what Trump did as president, but they're just not sure. They don't like all the drama that comes along with Trump. And so that's what someone like Ron DeSantis is hoping for, that over time that there's going to be some sort of fatigue. And so he might attract Republican voters who are tired of Trump. And then also by not directly criticizing the former president, he hasn't alienated that huge block of the Republican base that is still very supportive of Trump.
We have plenty to talk about tonight, and we're going to get right to it after I say it's 15 after the hour, and this is KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capital, in and around the nation's capital, and what it all means. All right, let's zoom down to Trump and DeSantis. They're coming to Iowa. Mr. DeSantis, Mr. Trump are going to be together, yes, on July 28th for the annual Lincoln Dinner at the Iowa Event Center. This is big because they have not shared the stage in Iowa during this election cycle.
Yes, I'm very curious to see what the speaking order is going to be and whether they refer to each other. So far, DeSantis has avoided criticizing Trump during his stump speeches. He has taken some shots at Trump when speaking to reporters afterwards, but not during a speech. Whereas Trump is, I think, more likely to take pot shots. I mean, that is just his style. Even during his previous campaigns, he does tend to criticize his opponents. A number of other candidates are going to be at that Lincoln dinner. And I want to mention this is something we've talked about before, but it just bears repeating. Every one of these huge cattle call Republican events for presidential candidates is a huge benefit to the Republican Party of Iowa and its candidates down ballot. These are all big fundraisers for the party. It generates excitement. It probably attracts more people to register to vote as Republicans. And so all of that can have benefits well into next year, well beyond the caucuses.
But even before the 28th, Zach Nunn is going to host Mr. DeSantis at an event on July 15th at the Ankeny Regional Airport.
Yes, Zach Nunn, this is of the four Iowa congressional districts, the third district, which where Zach Nunn narrowly defeated Cindy Axney last year, that is considered the most competitive. Election forecasters see that as a tilt Republican or a lean Republican district, depending on what system they use. I haven't heard of any declared Democratic candidates, but Zach Nunn is definitely going to be focusing a lot on fundraising this year and hoping to discourage other people from mounting a serious challenge to him.
So, while Donald Trump sucked up all the oxygen last week, some other candidates got into the race officially. One of them, the former Vice President Mike Pence, who came to Iowa to publicly launch his presidential campaign, and he talked about Mr. Trump and the Constitution.
Yes, he was a little more critical of Donald Trump than he has been in the past, and that he chose the Constitution when forced to choose between what Donald Trump wanted him to do and what the Constitution required of his job. That's speaking of certifying the Electoral College vote on January 6th. I mean, Pence is in a bind because he likes to talk about the accomplishments of the Trump administration that he was very much a part of. But that's tricky when Donald Trump himself is still in the race. So I think Mike Pence is still looking for that lane. He is still talking quite a bit about his Christian faith, and I think hoping to attract the religious, the Christian conservatives are a very important bloc in the Iowa caucuses. They have been for now just about 30 years. And so he is going to be focused on that, but we don't see a lot of evidence that he's gaining traction yet.
Right. And after he announced, he gave an interview to the Des Moines Register, and it was a quite interesting interview because he said he would support a national ban on gender-affirming care for transgender minors. That is a big announcement from him.
Well, and his PAC, as we discussed on previous shows, he got involved in criticizing the Lynmar School District's policy that was supportive toward transgender students. And this seems to be something that within Republican circles now, this is almost a litmus test issue that you have to talk a lot about transgender issues. And Donald Trump, during one of his rallies this weekend, he said, "Oh, I talk about tax and other things, but look, people go really crazy when talk about this transgender ideology." I mean, that's not an exact quote, that's a paraphrase, but he even commented on how the crowds react. And so I feel like that's a little bit, that's a note that a lot of the candidates are hitting. Nikki Haley, in her speech to Joni Ernst, Roast and Ride, she said that biological boys, as she called them, playing girls' sports is the women's issue of our time. I mean, it's just, it seems a bit of an, it's an odd thing to say, right, when we're just living in the year after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. But in any case, this is something that all of the candidates seem to feel the need to talk about in their stump speech.
And we should point out that about 19 Republican-led states, including Iowa, have passed laws to prohibit transgender people from accessing transition-related medical care. This was a big issue this year all across the country.
It was, but there was a court ruling, and we don't have time to discuss it in detail right now, but there was a federal court ruling in Florida that put on hold that state's ban on gender-affirming care for minors. And I expect that every state, the ban in Arkansas, which was already passed in 2021, it's already been challenged and put on hold by a federal court. So I think that all of these states are going to have a little bit of trouble having these laws upheld.
Another gentleman who jumped into the race last week, Chris Christie. Mr. Christie, former New Jersey governor, used to be best friends with Donald Trump. Now he is no longer best friends with Mr. Trump. And everybody knows that he's getting into this race to really call out Mr. Trump. He'd like nothing better than to get on a debate stage and chew Mr. Trump out. And that is not an exaggeration.
And Chris Christie and Donald Trump, I was listening to Josh Marshall's podcast a few days ago, and he was talking about how similar they are. There's a personality type, a very aggressive, kind of a belligerent style of speaking in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and they're cut from the same cloth. And they hit it off during the 2016 campaign. Chris Christie was one of the first of the former presidential candidates to endorse Donald Trump, but he was already on the outs even during the transition period after the 2016 election. Before Trump was inaugurated, Christie was on the outs. And so he has been very critical, not just of these latest criminal charges, but has accused Trump and his family members of profiting off the presidency. And so, yes, I don't expect Chris Christie to do much campaigning in Iowa. I think he's going to focus on New Hampshire, but definitely his focus is going to be to bring down Donald Trump.
And Mr. Christie said that other Republican candidates in the race are too timid to criticize Mr. Trump. That appears to be the case, but Mr. Christie is not at all timid.
Right. And also, he has nothing to lose. I mean, but we've discussed this before. It is very odd to have so many other candidates in the race afraid to criticize the front runner. That I can't think of any analogy to that, really, in any previous presidential campaign in either party.
All right, here's another candidate who jumped in last week. I'm going to say the name slowly, and then I'll repeat it. Doug Burgum. Now, I'm going to repeat that. Doug Burgum. No, it's not what the Des Moines Register called him in their headline in their Metro section yesterday. Bergman visits GOP voters in Ankeny. No, it's not Bergman. Doug Burgum. Who is Doug Burgum?
Well, I really didn't know much about him, the governor of North Dakota, but after watching his TV ads, I see that he is an independently wealthy, self-made business person. And so that makes me understand a little better why he's running for president, because that fits a type of presidential candidate we've seen in many cycles, a successful business leader who has lots of money to spend. And apparently he's already, Doug Burgum is already spending $3 million on TV ads in Iowa, New Hampshire that play up his rural background and his business acumen and his leadership, cutting taxes and balancing the budget in North Dakota.
Fascinating. So Mr. Burgum. Is now the 12th candidate, as I may have mentioned earlier, to jump into the race. And we have a parallel situation in this race compared to 2016, when everybody said, well, now some candidates would just get out. Now they can consolidate support beside one candidate as opposed to Mr. Trump. But nobody got out.
No, and Trump is in a much stronger position now, because in 2016, he was winning a lot of those primaries with 30%, 35%, 40% of the vote. And in a lot of the polls, he's above 50% already. So, I mean, it's not, people need to really bring him well below 50%. And then if it's reduced to a one-on-one race, somebody else may have a chance. But it's pretty difficult when the field is this splintered. And that's why, other than DeSantis, you really don't see, oh, and Chris Christie, of course, but you really don't see Donald Trump criticizing these other candidates, because I think from his perspective, the more the merrier.
Well, we've gone 24 minutes off the top of the show talking about the presidential race, mostly about Mr. Trump. There is a major story in Iowa that normally would have played higher, but it just got drowned out this past week. It happened on Wednesday night. Democrats in the state Senate ousted Minority Leader Zach Walls and replaced him with Senator Pam Yoakum. Highly unusual during this time of the year for this to happen. Laura, what in the world happened to Zach Walls?
So this was a big surprise. And I say, people say it, a week is a long time in politics. And this was a perfect example of that. Normally, the parties choose their legislative leadership after an election, and they don't vote on it again for the next 2 years until after the next election. So Zach Walls, I mean, he had just been in Cedar Rapids at an event representing the Senate Democrats. He had just been on Iowa PBS show, Iowa Press. And then all of a sudden, last weekend, there was an uproar within the Senate Democratic caucus. There are only 16 of them now. But Zach Walls had fired two longtime staffers, and a lot of people weren't happy about it. Now, I want to say that that was the event that led to the leadership challenge. That wasn't the only reason. I think that there was some dissenting opinion within the caucus. But in any case, there was a long meeting last Wednesday, and it seems like Zach Walls could see the writing on the wall. There was maybe some failure to read the room on his part, I think, before he made the staffing changes. But I got the impression that there were other differences. But in any case, he ended up withdrawing. And Senator Pam Yoakum, who's one of the longest serving legislators, she's been in the Senate since 2009. And before that, she served in the Iowa House for 16 years. She was chosen to be the next Senate Democratic leader. So a different generation, a different speaking style. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out.
So he posted a message on Facebook on Monday afternoon. He said, "There is always resistance to change and new ideas, and I stand by my decision because Iowa Democrats desperately need a new direction and leaders who will chart a new course." That implies that he was overthrown by old timers, by who knows, backstabber. Do you have any insight into this?
Well, I mean, it is clear there were definitely a long time. Many people in the caucus have served in the legislature for a long time. Zach Walls was first elected in 2018, and there are many of the Democratic senators have served for a long time before that and are very used to working with these two staffers who had been dismissed. I should also say that many other people in the legislature, the lobbyists and Republican lawmakers even, also had pretty good working relationships with the fired staffer. So, I mean, but I don't think that that was the only thing going on here. There are always differences over legislative strategy, over campaign strategy. Last year, the Senate Majority Fund, which is the main campaign funding arm for Democratic candidates, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a race involving an incumbent, Kevin Kinney. He lost. It really wasn't that close. It was a tough district. And then they didn't spend a lot of money in an Ankeny district that looks like maybe it could have been winnable. The Democratic candidate there only lost by about 500 votes. And so, I mean, there are things like that where some people have differences of opinion. I think sometimes during the legislative debates, questions about how many amendments should they offer, there are disagreements over that. So I do think, again, that the staffing decision was clearly a factor, but normally the minority leader has the authority to change staffing. So I really don't think that that was the only thing going on here.
We have about 90 seconds left. One story I found really interesting last week, in addition to all of these others, is that more Iowans than anticipated have applied for a new state-funded private school financial assistance program signed by the governor. Now, that's potentially going to cost the state much more than lawmakers have budgeted for.
That's right. The Republican legislature, they approved $107 million in this coming fiscal year budget to cover the cost of these education savings accounts. But so far, the applications are coming in well above expectations. Now, we don't know that all of the people who applied will actually qualify because the first couple of years of the program, there are income limits. However, if they do all qualify, then we're probably going to see the legislature next year have to come back and make some kind of special mid-year appropriation to cover that cost. And it just goes to show you that the Legislative Services Agency, they do excellent work, but their estimates about the cost of bills are only estimates. It's not written in stone that everything they put in their fiscal note is going to be exactly how much a program costs.
They had originally said it would cost $345 million over 3 years, but it may be maybe much more than that.
Well, they said the first year, $107 million, and then by the third year, $345 million a year. And so it could be well over that. We also don't know whether new schools online or brick and mortar schools are going to pop up to take advantage of this program. But the projection was that over 4 years, it was going to cost almost $1 billion. But if the first year ends up greatly exceeding that $107 million that they appropriated, then that's a pretty good sign that the subsequent years will also be more costly.
Laura, that's it. We are out of time. I'll see you next week in Ames.
It goes fast, Dennis. I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
You bet. It's going to be a busy week this week. We are out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Now, Laura and I are going to be back next week in the same time slot with a special edition of Capital Week. What's so special about it? Well, tune in and find out. And we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style, but with a twist. How's that for a tease? As always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and extraordinarily happy week.